This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Tropical storm Florence's winds and floods have now killed at least 11 people. It's also forced thousands to flee to safety, prompted hundreds of rescues and shut off electric power to nearly 1 million homes in the U.S. Southeast. We get more from AP's Ben Thomas.
Moving very slowly, nearly stationary.
Steve Goldstein of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says that could mean major flooding as far as the Appalachian Mountains of western North Carolina into early next week. And Florence has already proven deadly. Governor Roy Cooper says some 800,000 people are without power. Among them, Art Ferrero in Jacksonville.
We've actually been barbecuing just so we can eat. We haven't had power since Thursday.
With his neighbor's house already flooded and water still rising, Ferrero says,
if it actually comes any higher to where we're standing, the water will be inside the house.
I'm Ben Thomas.
A super typhoon crashed into China Sunday, having swirled past Hong Kong. It left a trail of deadly destruction in the Philippines. David Doyle with Reuters.
It made landfall on China's southern Guangdong province later on Sunday after barreling past the gaming center of Macau. There, casino gambling has been halted and China's People's Liberation Army is on standby for disaster relief. Manghut hit the Chinese coast with winds of up to 100 miles per hour. Ports, oil refineries and industrial plants in the area have been closed. And, according to state media, China has ordered thousands of boats back to harbour and evacuated offshore oil platform workers. Manghut's northwesterly track will then bring heavy rain and winds to the autonomous region of Guangxi on Monday, before it weakens to a tropical depression the next day.
Reuters' David Doyle. And a major U.S. meatpacking company has agreed to pay $1.5 million to settle charges of discrimination involving Muslim workers who walked off the job in a dispute over prayer breaks. The company Cargo Meat Solutions and 138 Muslim workers reached that agreement. This is VOA News. After losing his mother to war, 10-year-old Hikmatullah decided to join a peace movement, with members of which have been walking hundreds of kilometers to different regions of Afghanistan since June with the message of peace and an end to violence. He, like many Afghans, goes by one name and is calling on all warring sides in Afghanistan to make peace so he and others can return to school. His father had once joined him, but he's also returned to his hometown. Hikmatullah has decided to continue, and the group made it to Mazar Sharif city Friday, after walking barefoot a distance of close to 650 kilometers. At least 100 Myanmar, in the heart of Myanmar's largest city, held signs and chanted slogans denouncing the guilty verdict against two journalists there. We were told that our country is in a democratic transition, but we have to ask the question of why are things that are not related with democratic principles happening in this country, which is led by the democratic icon Aung San Suu Kyi? Is the democratic transition really happening in our country? Do we have media freedom? Whether our people are really able to access the right to information? And a small contingent of police looked on as the protesters released black balloons printed with the words Free Walloon and Kia Soo. U.S. President Donald Trump is likely to announce new tariffs on Chinese imports as early as Monday. That's according to a senior administration official speaking to Reuters. Lucy Fielder with Reuters has more.
Donald Trump is likely to announce new tariffs on Chinese imports as early as Monday, according to a senior administration official speaking to Reuters. The tariffs will be on about $200 billion worth of goods, including internet tech products and other electronics, and consumer goods, including Chinese seafood, furniture, plastics, and bicycles. The Wall Street Journal reported the tariff level will probably be about 10%, far below the 25% the administration said it was considering.
An Israeli opposition lawmaker Sunday called on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to dismiss his ambassador to the United States for failing to report sexual assault allegations against a top Netanyahu aide, ballooning an already embarrassing scandal for the Israeli leader. The Concentris Party's member said that Ron Dermer should be recalled from Washington for not reporting the warnings he received about David Keyes, Netanyahu's spokesman to foreign media. And the U.S. National Transportation Safety Board says that investigators do not suspect foul play in a series of natural gas pipeline explosions north of the city of Boston, Massachusetts, that left one person dead and it set dozens of houses on fire. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The masses, the people, the civil population of South Sudan know the truth. They know the truth that the government in Juba wants to maintain status quo at all costs.
The South Sudan main rebel group accuses the government of violating the recent ceasefire agreement.
We will continue to pursue the fundamental rights that we are seeking because nobody can give us on a plate, obviously. So we will use a lot of available avenues.
The Swaziland Democratic Party says it will continue to fight for more democratic reforms.
Government has got a policy of willing buyer, willing seller, to when they buy the land and then they redistribute it to the needy people.
Civil society groups want solutions to issues of land ownership in Namibia. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition, or SPLM-IO, is calling for an independent inquiry into recent attacks of its positions by government troops. The SPLM-IO says the attacks were aimed to undermine the recently signed ceasefire agreement between President Salva Kiir and former Affairs Vice President Dr. Riek Machar, but the government denies the accusation. Meanwhile, the UN mission in South Sudan has also called for an investigation after one of its peacekeepers was shot in the leg. For more about their concerns, I reach Manasseh Zindo, the SPLM-IO's chairperson of the National Committee for Culture, Youth, Empowerment and Sports.
We signed the peace agreement on Wednesday, which was the 12th of this month, and 2 days later, on the 14th, the government forces attacked our position simultaneously in two places, in a place called Lanya and in a place called Kajikoji. So our forces came under attack from the government, and they put up a defense to defend the position. That was what happened.
But the government officials are denying that government troops attacked your positions and that this is part of the plan of your group to always accuse the government of attacking your positions immediately you sign a peace deal with the government.
It is not true. What always happens is when the government attack our positions and we put up a defense to defend our positions, they turn around to say that it is us who attacked them. Immediately they attacked our position, our military spokesperson called on CITISAM. This is a mechanism which was put in place in 2015 under JEMEC to monitor who are the people violating the ceasefire. So our spokesperson immediately called on CITISAM to go to the area and do an investigation to identify who violated the ceasefire. I also understand that yesterday, the UN peacekeeping force in South Sudan also came under attack from the government because they were trying to leave their base in a place called Yei. So probably to stop them from going to the area, the government attacked them. Anyway, to really confirm who violated the agreement or who attacked first, CITISAM, the challenge is on CITISAM now to go to the area and document who attacked who first.
So you are calling on possibly IGAD or any mediators to investigate this latest round of attack. Is that what you are calling for?
Exactly. And this time around, the mediators, the guarantors, they need to be firm this time around that if an attack takes place, they should go immediately to the area, document what happened, and let the perpetrators be held responsible. Because this time around, the peace agreement we've brought, we don't want it to fail. And the only way that we can make sure that it does not fail is to hold those who are violating responsible.
This is yet another instance where an agreement has been signed and accusations and counter-accusations follow. How do South Sudanese repose confidence in the two sides that you really want peace when anytime you agree or sign an agreement, you go on attacking each other or you trade accusations and counter-accusations?
The masses, the people, the civil population of South Sudan know the truth. They know the truth that the government in Juba want to maintain status quo at all costs. And to avoid this blame game, that is why this institution called Citizen under JEMEC was put in place. What has been happening is that the government has been preventing Citizen in going to the areas where fight has taken place. So in this case, Kwame, even if you are not on the ground and you are told this story, then you can tell who is really violating the ceasefire. So the challenge is on the institution, JEMEC and the Citizen, to fly to the area, document what happened, and make the report public.
Manasseh Zindo is the SPLMIO's chairperson of the National Committee for Culture, Youth Empowerment and Sports. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. The leader of the yet-to-be-registered Swazi Democratic Party, or SWADEPA, says the group is undeterred in its commitment to pressure the administration to allow for more democratic reforms. Jean Sitoli says his party plans to call on the regional bloc, the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, and other international stakeholders to pressure the government in Mbabane to respect the constitution. His remarks came after the Eswatini Supreme Court rejected the party's petition seeking to remove the ban on political parties in the kingdom. To learn more about the petition, I read Jean Sitoli in Manzini.
First and foremost, Swaziland has been under a state of emergency decree for over 30 years. The 1973 draconian decree that banned political rights and human rights. But since the advent of the 2006 constitution, which allowed for the Bill of Rights, where there is no clause or sentence in the constitution which talks about the banning of political parties, but it allows for freedom of association, expression, assembly. We then believed that as a political party, we, according to the constitution and the Bill of Rights, we have a right to form ourselves and also participate and engage with all the fundamental rights that we need to campaign, to demonstrate, to deploy our members and talk about and campaign for them, fund also our sponsor our members. But we asked the court to declare our rights as a political party, the High Court. They did not. They just said we have rights, but it's individual merit. They are not going to explain any further, but we have all the rights that are enshrined in the constitution.
People of Eswatini are suggesting that if you are not a legitimately registered political party in Eswatini, then you don't have a basis to challenge the government to have you unbanned in court. The notion that political parties are prevented from participating in the elections in Eswatini. What's your take?
We also were of that opinion, but and then what we did was we officially wrote a letter to the Attorney General. We asked him to register us or asked the Minister for Justice to register us as a political party. They responded to say they have no obligation to register us. We exist as the Constitution and we have all the rights that is in writing. And that response was also attached to the court papers. So it cannot hold. That's also what the Elections and Boundaries Commission confirmed, that we have all the rights, we exist, and we can do everything but use individual merit when we deploy people. So it shouldn't have arisen as now a point in limine to say we are not registered.
What is your end game here?
Our end game is that we want a multi-party democracy in Swaziland. And we see a constitution that has the Bill of Rights that allows for fundamental rights. And therefore, we see that as an existing space for us to use in order to open up democratic spaces. So we feel that there is disingenuity on the part of the court if they will say the constitution gives you these rights, but you don't have the rights.
What is your next line of action? Because the two courts have disagreed with your stance. First, the High Court and now the Supreme Court. What is your next line of action to press home your demand for more democratic rights and freedom of rights?
Well, we will continue to pursue the fundamental rights that we're seeking because nobody can give us on a plate, obviously. So we will use a lot of available avenues. One would be actually directly asking for engagement and dialogue with government outside the court system. And if they agree, then there will be that will be a starting point. But in the event that it wasn't starting, then we will begin to look at the processes of engaging SADC to intervene.
Jean Sitole is the leader of the unregistered Swazi Democratic Party. He spoke with me from Manzini. Civil society groups say there's need for the issue of land ownership in Namibia to be addressed. This after media reports said findings by the Namibia Statistics Agency show that white commercial farmers still own 70% of commercial farmland in Namibia nearly three decades after independence. The Namibia Statistics Agency released the information last week at the National Land Statistics Conference in the capital, Windhoek. The conference was aimed at finding solutions to the issues surrounding land ownership. For more, I reach Alex Shimuafeni, Statistician General of Namibia and the CEO of Namibia Statistics Agency.
The data that we have put together, foreigners own about 250 farms in Namibia. Now, I just wanted to get to the figures so I can explain to you. That is about 1.2 million hectares of land that they are owning. And when you talk about 1.2 million hectares of land, if you talk about a viable commercial farm, you can talk about an average of 300,000 hectares. So those 250 farms can actually be converted into about 400 farms, commercial farms in Namibia. Those are the figures that we have. And I can give you a breakdown in terms of which countries or which nationalities own those farms.
I understand that, but some people are expressing worry that if Namibia were to be developed or feed its own people and be able to be productive with the arable land, then Namibians are not doing quite enough, or the government is not doing quite enough to ensure that indigenous Namibians own at least a sizable portion of the land that belongs to the country.
They could be right, but from my point of view, where I am, I need to, from a statistics point of view, as a statistician general, we give information that assists with policy formulation. Now, what I can tell you is that if you look at from whether it's Namibians or non-Namibians, that should not really be the issue. Now, to come back to your question in terms of whether government is doing enough to give land, you know, government has got a policy of willing buyer, willing seller, to when they buy the land and then they redistribute it to the needy people. Now, government, if you say that whatever they bought since independence is enough or not, that also depends on other factors such as whether the farms are up on offer, were they affordable, and were they also commercially viable? Those are the questions that you need to really to ask.
With the statistics that you've provided to Namibians, how do you engage these policymakers to ensure that your statistics are used to the benefit of the people of Namibia?
It's a very good question. You know, on the 1st of October until the 5th of October, government is going to have a national land conference. It's the second one because the first one was in 1991, I believe. It's 91 or 92, but I believe it's 91. Sorry for not having the correct year there. Now, for this year, there's a second National Land Conference. Now, we as a statistics agency, we said we cannot just let the people go and have debates without having the facts and figures. So that's why the timing of the release of the statistics is 2 weeks before the land conference, so that people who are going out there can go out with the facts and figures. So our job really is to provide policymakers with facts and figures so that they can also now make informed decisions. So this is our part that we do, what that we did. We have, for example, we released these statistics on Thursday, the 13th of September, where we invited all the data producers so that they come and validate this information. So this is our part that we play in terms of informing the policy makers.
Talk to me about the issue of other stakeholders apart from the government to having this land. You're talking about civil society organizations and other stakeholders who might want to participate in this dialogue and conference to ensure that the information you are providing them is beneficial.
Some of the stakeholders we have invited, like the Agricultural Bank of Namibia, who gives loans to commercial farmers, and also they also have provided us some information of some of the farms that were funded by that bank. It's a state-owned enterprise, the bank, the Agricultural Bank of Namibia, or what we call the Agribank of Namibia. We also have the Namibia Agricultural Union, which is a private union that is also dealing with commercial farmers. They also gave us information, and we had invited them also. And I'm sure they will also be at the land conference.
Alex Shimwafeni is the Statistician General of Namibia and the CEO of Namibia Statistics Agency. He spoke with me from Vintalk. People fleeing the violence in the English-speaking regions of Cameroon are going through systematic searches before being allowed to enter the country's French-speaking regions. This after the government claimed fighters were trying to enter with weapons. For VOA Moki, Edwin Kenzeka reports from Boya, southwestern Cameroon.
It is very busy here at the Mile 17 bus station in the English-speaking southwestern town of Boya, where at least 30 transport buses leave daily for either the French-speaking town of Douala or Cameroon's capital city, Yaoundé. Many people remain at the station, some with their mattresses, dresses and kitchen utensils, expecting more buses to arrive and transport them. Gabriel Binka, an official of a bus agency, says they have doubled fares from $8 to $16 because their vehicles return from the French-speaking towns empty, since many people are fleeing English-speaking towns and villages and no one is coming in.
As you will see behind me, passengers are there waiting for vehicles. Vehicles that were there this morning are already gone, and we are trying to see what is available, if we can get these people by the later hours of the day so that they can go out in order for people not to fall in trouble.
Among those leaving is businesswoman Philomena Maloke. She says the military searched her luggage and that of her two-month-old daughter at least seven times between Kumba, her town of origin, and Boya, where she arrived Saturday to continue to Yaoundé.
It's a pity that it's happening here in our country.
Bernard Okalia Bilai, governor of the English-speaking southwest region of Cameroon, visited the Mile 17 Motor Park Saturday to plead with people to stop the mass exodus. He says people are running away because of threats from separatist fighters to disrupt the October 7 presidential election and because of rumors the military is planning raids against the armed separatists that invaded many towns in the region.
There are fake news that the army will launch an attack. No, the army are not launching attacks. The army are there to protect the population and their property. Those who are abandoning their homes, you can see here, you have beds, furnitures. No, where are they going? No, we want them to stay at home.
The governor of Cameroon's English-speaking Northwest, Deben Chofor, says thousands are also leaving his region. He says the military has seized weapons. Some suspected fighters were hiding in their luggage as they left for French-speaking towns. Chauffeur says he is making an appeal for everyone traveling to verify their luggage to make sure traffickers are not hiding weapons in their bags.
I would like to launch an appeal here to ask them to collaborate with security services to denounce those that are threatening them to the security services so that together we fight to bring back the situation to normalcy.
Unrest began in Cameroon in November 2016 when English-speaking teachers and lawyers demonstrated against the overbearing use of the French language. Separatists took over and started demanding the independence of the English-speaking from the French-speaking regions of the bilingual country. The separatists have on social media insisted that they will disrupt Cameroon's October 7 presidential election in the English-speaking regions. They say they are an independent nation called Ambazonia and will not allow such an election in their land. The government is assuring the people of security. The United Nations reports that 300 people, including 130 policemen and the military, have been killed. Hundreds of thousands have fled for their lives to the bushes and towns in the French-speaking regions. At least 20,000 have crossed over to Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Boya, Southwestern Cameroon.
Aid money urgently needs to be redirected to the poorest countries in order to reach the United Nations goal of extending extreme poverty by 2030, according to a new report. The Overseas Development Institute says that currently middle-income countries receive more aid than the 30 poorest nations and warns at least 400 million people will still be living on less than $1.90 a day, despite governments pledging to eliminate all extreme poverty. For VOA, Henry Ridgewell has the details from London.
In northern Ethiopia, teams of workers dig irrigation channels through orchards and grain fields. Projects like this have turned arid plains into fertile farmland, and agricultural production has quadrupled. The report from the ODI credits Ethiopia's so-called Productive Safety Net program, launched in 2005, with lifting 1.4 million people out of extreme poverty. It enabled Ethiopia to avoid another famine during severe droughts in 2010 and 2015. In contrast, neighboring Uganda has recently seen extreme poverty levels rise, despite a rapid reduction in previous years. Marcus Manuel is author of the ODI report.
And one of the reasons is because climate change is starting to have an impact in that country. Now, in Ethiopia, they've managed, with a lot of support, partly from the US, to have programs that support farmers when a sudden climate and a weather event happens. Uganda, they didn't. So when they had a drought, and when that led to real increase in poverty. So it's a matter of having the right systems in place.
Ethiopia's program, the largest of any low-income country, pays beneficiaries to work on public works projects like irrigation, roads, schools, and health clinics, helping to create long-term poverty relief. Such programs are vital in ending extreme poverty, according to the ODI report, which says there is an annual funding shortfall of $125 billion in the three core sectors of education, health, and what it terms social protection transfers, or welfare.
You need to do economic growth to do part of things, and then you also need investment in the social sectors. You need to have both sides of the coin to make this work. The donors are investing both in growth and in social sectors, but they're not investing it in the right countries to near the extent that's needed. And in particular, in this report, we've identified 29 countries which can't afford the investment needed in the social sectors, and donors are not giving enough money to that group of countries.
The statistics are striking. Middle-income countries receive more aid than poorer countries, whose share of global aid has fallen over the past 6 years from 30% to 24%. As well as better aid allocation, the report says more donor nations need to reach the UN goal of allocating at least 0.7% of GDP to aid budgets. Without urgent action, the authors warn the goal of eliminating extreme poverty by 2030 will remain out of reach. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Porter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. But first, the top European United Nations refugee official says Europe has to agree on how to deal with migrants rescued in the Mediterranean Sea. After 2 days of talks with government officials in Italy, Filippo Grandi says European countries have to unite on addressing migrants arriving in Europe. For VOA, Sabina Castelfranco has more from the Italian capital, Rome.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, was very clear about the need to rescue anyone found at sea in the Mediterranean. He said migrants should be taken to the nearest safe port. Speaking in Rome, he praised the work of the Italian Coast Guard. Italy recently closed its ports to non-governmental organization vessels engaged in rescuing migrants in the Mediterranean. The Italian Interior Minister, Matteo Salvini, has said he no longer would allow migrants to disembark at Italian ports. He urged other European states to allow vessels carrying migrants into their ports. Salvini has repeatedly said Italy will not continue to assume the brunt of the migration issue. Grandi says although the flow of migrants has dropped this year, the lack of NGO vessels operating in the area has brought an increase in the number of migrant deaths at sea. He said he discussed and agreed with Italian government leaders on the need to provide more resources to end conflicts in the migrants' home countries and other root causes of the departures. He added he discussed with Italy's foreign minister, Enzo Moavero Milanesi, the need to push for the next EU budget to include important resources strategically aimed at stabilizing situations in crisis areas in order to stem unnecessary flows of people.
Le persone non vogliono andarsene, scappare, darsi nelle mani dei trafficanti, quindi offrire delle alternative.
Grandi said people do not want to leave their homes or flee or end up in the hands of traffickers. He stressed that is why offering economic security alternatives is very important, but that this can only occur with resources that go beyond those of each individual member state.
Bisogna arrivare a stabilire un meccanismo.
It is essential, Grandi said, to establish a mechanism that will deal with the arrivals of migrants and what happens to them after their arrival. And this mechanism must be shared by European nations. He said it is not possible to deal on a boat-by-boat basis, as recently has been the case. The majority of refugees who flee crisis areas go to neighboring nations, Grandi said. But often these countries lack the resources to provide humanitarian assistance. Therefore, he added, transit nations also require reinforcement of institutions to deal with the migrant movements. He explained that at present, the most complex and dangerous transit country is Libya, which is torn by violent conflict.
Ci troviamo in Libia perché in Libia c'è una vasta popolazione, non sappiamo i numeri esatti.
The UNHCR is present in Libya with the IOM, the International Organization for Migration, he said, because in Libya there is a large population of refugees living in extremely difficult conditions, many of them locked up in detention centers where the conditions are abominable and completely unacceptable. Grandi said the UN works to assist the most vulnerable people and organizes repatriations and humanitarian corridors so that they may find protection elsewhere. He added, however, that these channels must be intensified and that efforts must continue to obtain an end to the conflict in Libya. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports.
Let's begin with African football. Entente Setif of Algeria beat Wydad Casablanca of Morocco 1-0 in the first leg of the African Champions League. Wydad are the current holders of the title. Senegalese-born Daoudi Diamande scored the only goal on 16 minutes in Setif on Friday. The return match is on Friday in a showdown between clubs who have each won the competition twice. Wydad, if they win, will become only the fourth club after Egypt's Al Ahly, Enyimba of Nigeria, and TP Mazembe of DR Congo to successfully defend the title. Meanwhile, Ahly boosted their chances of reaching the semi-finals by forcing a goalless draw away to Haroya of Guinea. The other quarter-finalists are set for Saturday, with Primeiro de Agosto of Angola hosting TP Mazembe and Esperance at home to Etoile du Sahel in an all-Tunisian affair. In boxing, Saul Canel Alvarez claimed the WBC and WBA world middleweight titles by inflicting a first career defeat to Gennady Golovkin at Triple G with a gripping points win in their Las Vegas rematch. The Mexican's win prevented a repeat of the draw both men shared a year ago at the same venue. This was Triple G's first defeat in 40 fights, and comes as Alvarez is fighting for the first time since serving a 6-month drugs ban. Alvarez has six brothers who also hold professional boxing records. And in athletics, Kenya's Elijah Kemboi has won the Black Mowers Sydney Marathon with a time of 2 hours, 13 minutes and 37 seconds. Kemboi and Uganda's Thomas Anyeko stuck together for 40 kilometers of the 42-kilometer course until Kemboi made a break for it, 2 kilometers from Sydney Opera House finish line. Anyeko was second in 2 hours, 15 minutes and 52 seconds, followed by Bithman Adisei of Ethiopia in 2 hours, 16 minutes and 25 seconds. Mercy Kiberos of Kenya was the first woman to cross the marathon finish line on Sunday with a time of 2 hours, 31 minutes and 24 seconds. Another Kenyan, Eunice Jeptul, came second, and third place went to Zinasha Dibebe Getachui of Ethiopia. Finally, in rugby, South Africa pulled off a shock 36-34 victory over the world champions All Blacks in Wellington on Saturday. The South Africans were steered home by the accurate boot of Henry Pollard. It was New Zealand's first loss in the competition in 3 years, although they remain top of the table with 2 rounds still to play. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sport. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Animaliza, alinangata matamshi. Kamependeza kupitiliza, wanasemaga kadamshi. Akicheza na animaliza, alinangata matamshi. Singida Dodoma, ma, 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 ma. Twara na Kigoma, ma, 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 ma. Singida Dodoma. Toka zaman, kazu tobo kama zidani chenga nyingi ntafungisha kana wakajiza na kabaka tambaka mezani kote kote napigisha baby watagwan katotoke tukapo njiani uhakika mezi tisa roke Wanna
anasemaga kadamshi akicheza na nimaliza alinangata matamshi kamependeza kupitiliza anasemaga kadamshi akicheza na nimaliza alinangata matamshi singida dodoma ma 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 Mtwara na Kigoma ma 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 singida dodoma ma kabati inuka na uchezo kone wachati
lala kifu wan baby data usikie moyo wangu vile unavyoteta nikikupa mambo fun unacheka kasauti kachumba unaweka
lala kifu wan baby data usikie moyo wangu vile unavyoteta nikikupa mambo fun unacheka kasauti kachumba unaweka
so let me say wakinita buzi ni chune tena ringa kidogo
kupitiliza wanasemaga kadamshi akicheza na nimaliza alinangata matamshi kamependeza kupitiliza wanasemaga kadamshi akicheza na nimaliza alinangata matamshi singida dodoma ma 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 Mtwara na Kigoma ma 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 singida dodoma ma
When my time in, open combati.
We'll be right back.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last Monday, President Trump's National Security Advisor, Mr. John Bolton, made his first major speech since his appointment. The speech dealt with the International Criminal Court and the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It was a blistering attack on the ICC and the American attitude towards it. He warned the ICC not to attempt to prosecute American citizens or soldiers in Afghanistan. The failure to heed the warning would mean that the United States would move against prosecutors and judges of the ICC who could be prosecuted in United Nations courts. He also said that if the ICC continues to interfere in the American affairs, it will face sanctions on its financial transactions. Behind this, of course, was something which was not explicit, but relates to the fear of Israel and the United States that the ICC will try to investigate Israel's military actions in the West Bank and in Gaza, because the PLO had sought to ask the ICC to intervene. Some commentators saw the speech as an example of the American first principle. Others have said that it is a license to dictators, and in this case, they referred to Africa. But in fact, this is not a new attitude of the United States. Although President Clinton signed the ICC accord, the U.S. Congress never ratified it. Accordingly, the U.S. is not a real member of the ICC. Although President Obama gave some staffic support to the ICC. One can also interpret this speech of Mr. Bolton as something to help the world understand the attitude of the African states towards the ICC. It should not be forgotten that the African states were the first to embrace the notion of ending impunity for atrocities. In the International Law Commission of the United Nations, under the chairman of an African, they began and sowed the seed for what became the Rome Treaty and then the ICC. But the problem for African states was that when the ICC started operating, the first chief prosecutor focused too much on the African continent. And in fact, the ICC continue to focus on the African continent. The real reason is that African states are weak and they are not able to push back on the ICC. We are now seeing that states like the United States, the Philippines, Russia are all pushing back against any attempt by the ICC to investigate them. And one of the strangest factors with the ICC is that the Security Council have been referring cases to the ICC. But many of the permanent members of the ICC are not signatories of the ICC. Now, what the ICC has to do is to try to reevaluate its relationship with Africa now that they are under severe attack from the United States. The ICC has not treated the Africans with respect, and that may account for the fact that the African Union called on all African states not to work with the ICC. But also one must ask Africans, particularly local NGOs who have been very friendly to the ICC, to understand that it is necessary for the ICC to act as an international organization. Some have dubbed the ICC as the International Caucasian Court. They are not only atrocities in Africa. They are all worldwide. They are not only corrupt people in Africa. They are worldwide. Why not pursue all of those crimes that are going on? Take, for example, now Yemen. Take, for example, what goes on in the Gaza. So unless the ICC begins to broaden in base, it is going to have problems in Africa. When Africans refuse to arrest Bashir when they had entered the country, they were criticized by members of the international community for not adhering to the ICC arrest warrants. But what have they done to Africa? In Uganda, when the attempt was made to sign an agreement and Africans appealed to the ICC to waive its arrest warrants, they refused. When the African Union called on the ICC to suspend his arrest warrant for Bashir. They refused. So now, with new realities, they should try now to see and work with the Africans, because they are the natural allies of the ICC and not those who are applauding the ICC from the background. But if there's any attempt by the ICC to investigate those very same countries, they will get a pushback. Africans must understand the way the international community operates. There are double standards. In fact, in one instance, a prominent member of a prominent member justified the use of double standards. But Africans cannot continue to be seen as the sick man of the international community. And they should read carefully the speech of Mr. Bolton and to see why they cannot just take the ICC at face value. So now the option is to the ICC and its chief prosecutors to reach out to Africans so that together they can try to defend the ICC against this new powerful attack. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, reporter Douglas Impoga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Tiang Wang, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, if a lion is found of patronizing the market center, it will be treated like a puppy. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Religious freedom is often called America's first freedom. It is the first freedom America's founders included in the U.S. Constitution's Bill of Rights. Speaking at the recently concluded ministerial to advance religious freedom, Vice President Mike Pence declared the United States will continue to lead the world by example in promoting this freedom. The Vice President expressed concern over growing religious intolerance in many countries around the world, including countries in Europe. In Russia, for example, more than 170,000 Jehovah's Witnesses are legally banned from practicing their faith. Government agents have seized Jehovah's Witnesses' headquarters near St. Petersburg, raided their prayer halls across the country, and arrested and imprisoned scores of believers. Just 70 years after the Holocaust, attacks on Jews in Europe, even on aging Holocaust survivors, are growing at an alarming rate. The United States is also concerned about increasing incidents of anti-Muslim hatred. The United States is working with many European governments and multilateral organizations, like the European Union and Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, to combat anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim discrimination. The American people will always cherish religious freedom, and we will always stand with peoples across the world, including Europe, who stand for their faith.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.